Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
So, John, we have your interview with Dr. Helen Sharman, Britain's first astronaut later on, and Constellation of the Month, of course, and what to look for in the night sky next month. But first, what's happening in the world of astronomy and space then, John?
Hello, Dave. Hello, listeners. Yes, indeed, an exclusive interview in just a little while. So just a few interesting items of over the last month or so.
Now look at Titan, which is Saturn's largest moon. It's a huge moon. It's half as big again as Earth's moon, and in fact is larger than the planet Mercury. It's the only moon in the solar system with an atmosphere, a dense atmosphere, comprising mostly nitrogen, but with clouds of methane and ethane. And this dense atmosphere is impenetrable to cameras. Titan, you might remember, was visited by the European Space Agency's Huygens lander in 2005, which parachuted down, soft-landed, and sent signals back to Earth for about 90 minutes. But since then, whenever Cassini's orbit takes it close enough to Titan, its radar instruments have been studying the moon's surface, where there are known to be lakes of liquid methane. A team at Jet Propulsion Laboratory has just been studying these lakes and has reported that there are wind-blown waves on these lakes. But the waves are tiny, just 1 centimetre high. But it's important to know this, as it'll affect the design of any future landing missions, some of which might land on the rocky surface, others might land actually deliberately in the lakes. So they'll need to know about the kind of behaviour on these lakes. No missions are currently planned, given the likelihood of potential life forming from hydrocarbons that abound on the moon's surface. And it's so important that nothing from Earth pollutes that possibility of future life. So, our next stop is Mars. Mostly when we mention Mars and Mars rovers, we immediately think of the big car-sized rover called Curiosity. That's currently exploring Mount Sharp and its surroundings. However, we shouldn't forget another smaller and much older lander called Opportunity. This landed as long ago as 2004, and despite having a projected lifespan of just a few months, it's still going strong, an amazing achievement. It's been observing a feature called Perseverance Valley, which is its next target to visit. This valley is interesting in that it appears to have been carved by fluid, and so Opportunity will study it to see what carved it, whether it was water or an icy debris mixture flowing, or perhaps even by sand blown by ancient winds, much stronger in the thicker atmosphere that Mars used to have. Today, its atmosphere is very much reduced. At present, there's no communications between Mars and Earth, so the rover is just parked. This is because Mars is on the far side of the Sun, and that interferes with signals. Now, on the subject of launching to the ISS, last month I mentioned Stratolaunch. You might remember this. It was Paul Allen from Microsoft's involvement, the world's biggest plane. And I mentioned that it might launch a scaled-down version of a lifting-body-type space plane called Dream Chaser. Well, there's some news on that score. Its builder is a company called Sierra Nevada. And they, together with United Launch Alliance, have announced the most powerful version of this Atlas V rocket that I've already mentioned. This one will have 5 strap-on boosters and a twin-engine upper stage, so we'll send the first 2 Dream Chaser cargo missions to the International Space Station from Cape Canaveral in 2020 and 21. These will be unmanned cargo missions. But that's a schedule that they've proposed, and they're awaiting confirmation by NASA. This lifting body spaceship, which looks like a small shuttle, is designed to lift off on the top of a standard conventional rocket and land on a runway, just like the space shuttle did. But it can deliver about 12,000 pounds of experiments, hardware, supplies to the space station on each of the unpiloted missions. The Dream Chaser's going to weigh about 20 tonnes when fully fuelled at launch, so that's why it needs such a large rocket, a United Launch Alliance's biggest version of their Atlas V. And that Atlas V is the one that I've just mentioned is going to be taking the first crewed flight of the Boeing Starliner capsule. NASA has awarded Sierra Nevada a commercial cargo contract just alongside Orbital ATK with their Cygnus craft and SpaceX with their Dragon to supply the spacecraft with reusable supplies and so on. And that's scheduled to go on through to 2024. The test vehicle for Dream Chaser is currently at Edwards Air Force Base, where it's just about to be dropped from height underneath a helicopter, and from there it will glide into a landing on the runway. I'm sure Sierra Nevada will persevere and get the crewed version of Dream Chaser approved by NASA at some point and into operation. It's notable that even the uncrewed version still has a cockpit all ready to go.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
So let's look at the constellations that are coming up into view over September. Hercules and Lyra, Altair, Cygnus, all well placed, but interesting ones coming up are going to be Pegasus and Andromeda, and we'll talk in more detail about those in another month. But the Milky Way is brilliantly placed this month. Do try and get out there and have a look for it if you get good clear skies. In terms of the moon, the third quarter is going to be on the 12th. Try and avoid looking when it's the full moon because it washes everything out. New moon, best for dark sky objects, is on the 19th. But in terms of looking at the moon itself, yeah, the 27th, you can't beat the first quarter. Let's move on to think about the planets. Mercury is actually probably the best chance to see Mercury for the rest of this year, but it does mean getting up in the morning. It's in the east as a pre-dawn object, really best from the 6th to the 20th. A bright spark above the eastern horizon at magnitude minus 1. Venus, still another brilliant morning object, but mag minus 4, so you can't miss that. Rises about 2 hours before the sun at the start of the month. Mars, yet another morning object, I'm afraid, but a lot fainter than Mercury. It won't be too far from Mercury, but best from the 11th of September onwards. Jupiter is still one of the evening planets, still visible, but now increasingly lower and getting lost in the murk by the end of the month. Saturn, still there, still visible, still a wonderful sight in telescopes, but remember, it is quite low, just 15 or so degrees above the horizon, in the south to southwest. Uranus and Neptune, yeah, they're both visible, but Uranus in the morning and Neptune is now becoming an evening object, but you really do need detailed star maps to help you to find those, and they're not naked eye visible either. Events of interest. We start off the month with Venus quite close to the Beehive Cluster in the constellation of Cancer. That's Messier M44, and Venus is within 2 degrees of it on the first, so in the morning, of course. Moon and Mercury close together on the 4th. Mars less than a degree from Mercury on the 16th. So if you can find your way to Mercury on the 16th, you should also be able to find your way to Mars. Again, morning objects. Still more morning sights. Venus and the Moon less than a degree apart. That will be a wonderful sight on the morning of the 18th. Jupiter's close to the Moon on the 21st. 22nd, an interesting date for astronomers, the autumn equinox. That's the date when the day and the night are of equal length, and so the nights start getting longer, more stargazing possible. 26th, Saturn, close to the moon, near midnight. On the 23rd of September, the National Trust are holding an event called the Wey River Festival at Dapdoon Wharf in Guildford. And Guildford Astronomical Society will have telescopes there to show you the night sky. That's a free event, I believe, and it's open until 10 o'clock. Local astronomical societies, Guildford's Astronomical Society's first session of the new year, the 7th of September, Thursday, the Gaia Revolution by Dr. George Seabrook, who was at Mallard Space Science Laboratory. I've heard this talk elsewhere. It's brilliant, really, really interesting, about measuring the distance of stars through this incredible instrument aboard a satellite called Gaia. Farnham Astronomical Society, 12th of September, A Universe of Dwarf Galaxies by Dr. Samantha Penny, University of Portsmouth. Croydon, I'm sorry, I don't yet know their title and date, best check on their website. Yule Astronomical Society, Hunting for Exo-Rings and Exoplanets in Our Galaxy. Okay, Professor Matthew Kenworthy, he's from the Leiden Observatory in the Netherlands. That's it for my prognostications for the coming month.
Thank you, John.
So now, Dave, our exclusive interview. This was recorded a few weeks ago, and I was delighted to meet Helen Sharman, Britain's first astronaut, and she was kind enough to agree to this interview, which I do hope the listeners will find interesting.
I'm Helen Sharman, and you're listening to Stars Over Surrey on Brooklands Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm currently at Broadwater School, south of Guildford, for a special space-related day known as Get Space. And this is the fourth of consecutive of these events. Get Space is run by SpaceLink, an organisation set up to promote an interest in spaceflight and related areas. It's aimed at school children, and it's for schools from all over Surrey. I'm here, together with a colleague from Guildford Astronomical Society, and we're showing the children the surface and atmosphere of the Sun through very specially constructed and heavily filtered telescopes, so it's quite safe. As fun as this might be for the children, the highlight of the day for the youngsters is definitely going to be meeting Helen Sharman, OBE, Britain's first astronaut. She spent 8 days in space in 1991, most of those aboard the Russian Mir space station. Helen has very kindly agreed to a short interview with me for Brooklands Radio and Stars Over Surrey. Helen, I'm delighted to meet you, and thank you very much indeed for this opportunity to talk to you. You are, of course, a patron of SpaceLink Learning Foundation, and you've supported this for several years since it started, I believe, and you're clearly very interested in keeping it going. We clearly have a common interest there in promoting an interest in spaceflight and astronomy amongst school children. So what is it that excites you about days such as this and an organisation such as SpaceLink?
I think anything that really gets across to people, particularly young people, the excitement, actually, although we're talking about space, for me, it's actually what's behind that. So I think I've always thought of space as being, yes, of course, it's an amazing opportunity, and isn't it exciting to consider our place in the universe, the mysteriousness of the whole thing, the beauty of everything. But actually, in order to study it, we need that science. And I think, and what I like very much about these kind of days is that I think young people pick up on bits of science that they might not otherwise do, because they just love the interest of space.
Absolutely, absolutely. And although, you know, we focus on the astronauts who are the pinnacle of getting into space, but behind those astronauts there's an army of scientists, of technicians and engineers, all sorts of career possibilities for youngsters to be thinking about. So are there any special areas that you like to interest youngsters in? I know your own background, of course, is chemistry, but there's all sorts. There's life sciences, bioscience, geology, astronomy, all sorts of areas that are related.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, science, you can't really pocket it. I mean, we do still think of physics separate from chemistry, separate from biology, and that's often how it's taught. But actually, increasingly, science is becoming more of a one body again. And we have all sorts of different degree subjects now, and I think that is filtering back into school life as well. You know, you can't think about biology. You can't really understand it unless you understand chemistry. You can't really understand a lot of chemical processes unless you understand physics. To understand physics, you need maths. And actually, the statistics comes right back to biology and living organisms. And so it is all in one, really. No one person can be to be the world expert at every aspect of science, because we now are so good at science, we know so much compared to a few hundred years ago, that actually we've had to specialise. But interestingly, even though we specialise, now those boundaries are getting very, very fuzzy. And I think that's the fun of it, you know. Science just describes the way we are, the way our world is, the way our universe is made up. And I think the less we imagine different pockets of it and the more we just open up to it, it's a way of understanding. And we're back to philosophy then, aren't we, really?
Fantastic. Thank you, Helen. You mentioned degree courses there. But, of course, not every child is cut out to go on degree courses. But I would still think that there's opportunity there for people who want to move into the direction of technicians, engineers, and maybe apprenticeship schemes to join those sorts of companies, like, for example, the Gaia space probe at the moment has got an incredibly sensitive chip on it. It's more sensitive than anything else that's been put into space for its measurement of parallax. And that was developed in the UK. And there must be loads and loads of technicians sitting behind there. And, you know, if business encouraged apprenticeship schemes leading into those areas, then wonderful opportunities for children of today.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the right now, with the new sort of emphasis on apprenticeships for science technicians, and apprenticeships have never died in this country. We've always had them, but they've tended to be what I call very practical kind of applications. So you might become a machine tooler, so you know how to work a lathe and other machine tools very, very well, and you can make tiny metal parts high precision. You might be an apprentice bricklayer, but they've tended to be quite practical applications. Whereas now, I think what we're starting to understand is that actually you could be a science technician. Mm. And of course, they've always existed in schools and in universities to support a lot of the research and teaching that goes on. But nonetheless, to be able to actually to have a career as a technician rather than have to go through the university route. And I think actually very many able people will also choose the apprenticeship route, especially those people who prefer to think about their science being much more applied, like getting stuck straight in, you know.
It's great to see the enthusiasm there for what might happen in the future and how to get youngsters involved. Does SpaceLink get involved with local educational authorities in trying to promote the spaceflight and related sciences, or with businesses? I know we've got several here, like SSTL, for example. Is there areas that SpaceLink would like to move into, do you think?
Well, SpaceLink's always been set up to make science interesting through use of space resources. And we have a number of teachers' lesson plans to enable teachers who would not otherwise feel able to talk about space, even though they know it's interesting. They just somehow need the resources. They need the material. They need some facts. Teachers have got all sorts of stuff they have to do, particularly these days, I think, and life can be quite hectic for them. So anything that makes it a bit easier for them to talk about space. So that's where SpaceLink is, I think, is particularly useful. And these lesson plans are available through ESRO, the European Space Agency's regional office based in York, actually, in the UK. But in other places as well, through SpaceLink. And we also have like online clubs, information resources for students to get directly from SpaceLink virtually. And it's days like today where sort of a few and far between. We just do it once a year, but where we actually gather students together and provide things like your activity, which is really super. And I think however much you do that's, let's call it virtual, and however much information is there, and students, of course, find it very easy to access, it's still really great for them to get their hands on something. Yes. And to actually see with their own eyes something. Yes. Actually happening.
What I enjoy is hearing all the wows when they look through.
wonder if I may ask you about your own mission, going back a little while, because I came to see you do your talk at the H.G. Wells Centre in Woking, and one of the things I particularly remember you saying about the difficulties that you hadn't really quite expected was the noise level once you were aboard Mir. So what was it that caused that noise level, and how did you deal with it?
I think that was one of the things that, although I knew it was going to be, there was a noise level was going to be there, it was something like 70 decibels, something like that, so it's quite loud. I mean, you shout to make each other heard over that kind of noise. And, you know what it's like when you turn off your computer at the end of the day and suddenly, ha, and it's the fan that has actually been keeping the computer cool that actually creates the noise. And we had a huge number of fans on board the space station because... And we needed those fans to circulate the air. And that's not just because it was quite warm and it's nice to have a fan on a hot day. The air doesn't normally circulate on board a space station unless you make it move, because convection, you know, warm air rises because a bit of warm air weighs less than the same volume of cold air. But if the air is weightless... Warm air is the same as cold air. It's the same density, so it doesn't necessarily rise. So you don't get convection currents on an orbiting space station. So yeah, so if you yourself are moving through the air, that's fine. Not only do you then create a bit of circulation, but you're always in a bit of fresh air. But if you do nothing about it and you stay still as you breathe out all of this nice warm air, which naturally would rise on Earth, but it doesn't in space. And gradually you sort of end up breathing back in the air that you've breathed out, and the carbon dioxide concentration rises and rises. So actually you suffocate in your own breath if you don't circulate the air. So the fans are really vital. In fact, if it goes quiet in space, then you're worried, because yes. you need to make sure you've got the fresh air. So yes, so different fans, and fans have to circulate the air through these long thin modules. Yes. So they can create quite a noise.
So were earplugs provided, or did you just have to grin and bear it?
We didn't actually have earplugs. In fact, if you do have earplugs, then it means that the alarms are less audible. An interesting sort of state of affairs. So it's not awful, the noise, it's just a bit tiresome. Astronauts' hearing does diminish a bit, and one of my jobs really was to monitor our hearing levels, and especially those that have been up there for quite a while. The astronauts' families, when they get back to Earth, complain because they want the TV turned on too loudly. So it can be a problem. In fact, we're trying desperately to diminish the noise of these fans now, so International Space Station is improved. I understand from Tim Peake, actually, that it's not too bad. It's still in the low 60s decibels, but different modules actually have different volumes of background noise. And Tim told me that the Japanese module is the quietest. Isn't that lovely?
So I'm sure they all want to go and do their sleeping over that side. Oh, interesting. Thank you. Of course, one thing that you share with Tim Peake is that you both went up on the Soyuz rocket, which is a fantastic workhorse, and it's been in use for decades, and it's still going, it's steady, it's safe, and also, of course, the Soyuz module itself. Tim's was the TM, wasn't it, so a little bit upgraded, but that's been going for such a long time. Do you happen to know whether the Russians are, Roscosmos, are trying to develop anything new? We know, of course, NASA are developing their Orion craft and so on, and SpaceX are doing their crewed Dragon. Is there anything new that's thought of from the Russian side that you've heard about?
Well, all the novelty has really been from other countries, I would say, more from Europe and more from America, from NASA. So you alluded to the different sort of variations. The Russians have flown different variations. I think Tim's was a TMA something or other, actually. Mine was a TM. So yes, so Soyuz started off as a plain old Soyuz. Yes. So it's gone through small incremental changes, but. You know, it's nothing like we would say novel, not really innovative. Now, in some respects, this is quite good because the Soyuz, you said it was very safe, it's a good workhorse. And in fact, I would much rather go on Soyuz than on anything else because it's tried and tested, not particularly comfortable, but, you know, ho-hum, I'd rather be safe. And yeah, it works well. But we do really need something else. I mean, we're relying on this very old-fashioned chemical propulsion. If we can get something that is, let's say, makes it perhaps an easier ride, something where you're not sitting on top of all of these tons of basically flammable combustible materials, it would be so much better. And that's what I think what we really need to be doing now. And of course, electric propulsion has been actually for quite some time being researched. We are already using electric propulsion on satellites once they've actually got what we call into space, so out of sort of the clutches of Earth's gravity. We're still relying on chemical propulsion. We need that impulse to get us up there. So that's where the real innovation comes. If anybody is really thinking hard, I think there's money to be made if you can develop a really high impulse engine that's not relying on chemicals.
Well, you never know. Some of the children that have been here today might find themselves working on it or even propelled by it at some time in the future. Helen, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much indeed for giving up some of your time for Brooklands Radio. But I think we've both got our duties to get back to. I need to get back to my telescopes, and I'm sure there's lots of children waiting to talk to you. So, Helen, thank you very much again.
My pleasure.
Well, that was something. My very first interview, and with a real live astronaut. It was really good to meet her, and she was very kind in agreeing to do this interview for us.
John was at this week's Eclipse in America and sent us this report.
Hi, this is John Axtell from Brooklands Radio, and I'm over in Wyoming at a place called Bass Lake, which is near Shoshone in Wyoming, and here enjoying the Great American Eclipse. It's been going for about 20 minutes at the moment, so I've been busy taking photographs. I've got a special, what we call a BARDA, white light filter, over the camera. So it's perfectly safe to take what I hope to be good photographs of this event. Just taking one every 10 minutes or so. But interestingly, the sun has got some sunspots on it at the moment, which it hasn't for the last few weeks. It's been very, very bare. But we've got a whole string of about four or five spots in the middle of the sun at the moment, and the moon disk is just edging and covering some of those sunspots as I speak at the moment. So we've got another half an hour or more to go before we get to what we call second contact, which is when the moon's disk completely obscures at the sun, and that's when we take off all of these white light filters off both my little telescope and also the camera, because that's when the sun's corona can be seen out of the side of the sun, and that's the big spectacle. That's what makes a total eclipse so unique. We see partial eclipses quite frequently, but the total eclipse is something quite special, quite different. Oh, but by the way, I should have mentioned that we're in a wonderful field here by the side of the lake. And there must be about six coachloads of people, probably about 40 mobile homes set up here because it's such a good spot. There's a little coffee place and a little bar, so people could use the facilities and enjoy themselves. I'm sure a lot of people will be heading to the bar after it's all over. And we must have 300, I would guess, people just at this one little corner in our coach trip down today from Thermopolis, which is where we've been staying. All the way down, we've been seeing similar little sites set up at the side of the road. Thank goodness the traffic hasn't been as bad as was feared because of so many people coming out to see the eclipse. It was feared that the roads would get clogged. Maybe it has in some of the larger urban areas, but this is such a big country. There's bags of room for everybody. So I'll talk again a little bit later when we have, just after we've had totality. I'll be too busy enjoying it to make any recordings. Well, that was absolutely something else. That was fantastic.
total eclipse was about a quarter of an hour now over, and I'm just finishing my celebratory beer. What a splendid occasion. The sky was darkening as more and more of the moon was obscured. More and more of the sun was obscured by the moon. It really got noticeably cooler. And looking off towards the north, we could see the northwest, rather, we could see the shadow starting to streak towards us, and then totality started. And what you get to start with is what we call a diamond ring, and that's just when the final part of the sun's edge is just about obscured by the moon, but with a little bit left over, and you get this wonderful effect, bright prick of light at one side of the moon, and then totality itself. And that's when the corona, the outer atmosphere of the sun, can be seen for the first time. And that stretches perhaps 4 or 5 diameters of the sun out each side, getting fainter as it gets further away from the sun. An asymmetric shape, but exactly as the astronomers had predicted the shape would be, because we have satellites up there that are observing the sun all the time, and they can observe the lines of magnetic force that's surrounding the sun, and they know that the vapours, the gases, the plasma within the corona are going to follow those lines of force. And so the shape was two streamers out at the bottom of the sun, quite long, about 3 sun's diameter, stretching out both left and right, and just above 2 slightly smaller streamers. But just a little bit away from the sun could be seen the planet Mercury and also Jupiter. Jupiter was in evidence well before totality, in fact. So it was over all too soon. I spent about 40 seconds, I suppose, of totality taking photographs, trying different exposures to try to bring out the detail within the corona. But then for the remaining minute, 2 minutes that was left, just observing it, just enjoying it. And the 2 or 3, however many hundred people here, were all jumping up and down and crying out and calling. And it was a splendid, splendid experience. So well done in America for hosting this special eclipse of 2017. There will be another one in the United States, and that will be in 2024. I'm already starting to think, could I manage to get over here then too? You never know. So this is John Axtell signing out for Brooklands Radio. Bye now.
This programme will be repeated on Monday night at 11 o'clock, and the next edition will be Friday 29th of September at 7:30 p.m.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.